Okay, very good. Once again, I have a request for the talk this evening. I'm always very willing to field requests. It was a special request, so I'm fitting it in this week. It's an old Buddhist concept, but I'm going to keep plucking away at this concept in different ways every time. It's the concept of rebirth, a very fundamental teaching of the Buddhist religion. And not only is it a fundamental teaching, it's a very useful teaching. I keep on trying to explain, encourage, elucidate the teachings of rebirth because it affects you. When you put your life in the big picture, not just one life but many lives, then you can have some idea of where you've come from. And you've got some idea of where you're going to. And it just makes the whole journey we call this life a bit more interesting. It puts things in perspective. And it's fascinating, the whole history of the idea of rebirth. All the Greek philosophers, they were all into rebirth without an exception. All those Socrates, Plato, Heraclitus, Pythagoras, they were all into rebirth. And so it was actually part of Western culture. When people in the West say that their culture originated from Greece, and that's where rebirth was very, very strong. It was only about, I think, the 3rd or 4th century in some council of Nicaea where it was voted down as not being right by the Christian authorities at the time. And it's always tended to disappear from Western culture, but always survived in Eastern culture. And now it's coming back again into Western culture, little by little, as the evidence mounts that, yes, there are people who can remember their past lives, and that can be checked, and it's right, and it's true. And if one person can remember their past lives, and it's true, then, of course, it makes it very, very easy to infer that if one person's been reborn, then why not everybody? In fact, it seems quite silly to me that we've only get reborn once into this world and we die. It doesn't really make sense at all. If we're born once, why not twice? Why not three times? Why not many times? And indeed, when one looks at life, when one looks at nature is always working in cycles. Whether it's the planets going around the sun going around the solar system, whether it's the cycles of nature, days and nights, seasons, everything goes round and round. And when we actually understand that, there's no reason why our life can't go round and round. From life to death, another birth, another life, again and again and again. It seems much fairer and more sensible, especially that sometimes when we, as it were, pick the short straw and only have a short life, and other people have a long life. It seems very unfair for some people to get the short straw, the thin end of the deal, or the poor end of the deal, and only have a short time. And also there's so much to learn, so much to experience in this world that 50, 60, 70, 80 years is not enough. Everything goes round in cycles. Even soap operas get their reruns, so why can't we? So when we think of it that way, it sort of makes much more sense. But I've given before evidence for rebirth. If you want to find out the evidence for rebirth, the scientific evidence for rebirth, and there is lots of it, you can always go into the library or go in on the internet and type in Professor Ian Stevenson, who did heaps of research, not just by himself, but with other accredited researchers. And he wrote many books. One of his books was written as a visiting fellow of Magdalen College in Oxford. I remember that. So he wasn't some sort of weirdo, not some sort of like New Age fanatic. He was actually accepted in academia as a bona fide professor. But one of the strange things, and life is always strange, it's always weird. One of the strange things was his life's work was sponsored. And it was sponsored by an American corporation whose name you all know. It was sponsored by Xerox, the company who specializes in photocopying. decided to sponsor research into photocopying human lives called reincarnation. Fascinating. But nevertheless, that research was done. And that research is amazing to read, just all the evidence which he collected over the years. So anyone who says it's not scientific, you should ask them, have you read the proofs yet? And a lot of times they say, no, 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 because they never even think there are such proofs there. So imagine what it's like if you could accept that and believe that and understand it, because it is true. When you die, and that will happen to you, you'll find a very strange experience. And the strangest part of the experience of dying is how normal it feels. It's not strange at all. There's a continuity of the conscious process at the time of death. It's as if your body dies. Not as if, it is like this. Your body dies, but your mind continues. Which is why it is that sometimes people die temporarily. And they come back again afterwards to tell the tale of what it's like to die. These are called out-of-the-body experiences. And incredible how many people have these. You don't have to be a Buddhist to have an out-of-the-body experience. Christians, Muslims, atheists. When a person physically dies, they go out of their body. And more scientific evidence. It was in Lancet, the journal of the British Medical Association, the most stiff upper-lipped organization probably in this planet. And they did some, research. They printed, published some research done by these Dutch doctors who were investigating this phenomena of out-of-the-body experiences in their hospital. And one of the things they found, first of all, they said, yes, it happens. It works. There is such a thing as out-of-the-body experiences. They actually titled their paper, I think, Consciousness Survives Death. Because they found the only time this happens, this is what they correlated, they found the only time it happens is when a person is medically dead. Where not only the heart is not beating, but the brain is inactive. Your brain dead. That's when you float out of your body. So anyone who says that, you know, these out-of-the-body experiences are some sort of stimulation of part of the brain was completely disproven by that research. It was discounted as impossible, because with the instruments on those bodies, on the operating table in the hospitals, there was no brain activity whatsoever at all. They were brain dead, but they were still very much alert. That's what we mean by being dead. Your heart is not beating, your brain ain't working, but something else is working. That's what we call the mind. That's what happens when you die. Only real death is it just carries on. You don't get revived again. You don't sort of come back after a very short time. And so you go off to a new body, to a new place. Different time, different place, a different body. But people who have those out-of-the-body experiences, at least they know what happens at death. But those of you who haven't had out-of-the-body experiences, you can have in meditation experiences instead, which is another way of finding out what happens when a person dies. The meditation which we did earlier was just scratching the surface of what's possible to do when you really go inside. And many of you who've been on my retreats, my meditation retreats, especially the long ones, have heard me describe now how you can get into very, very deep states of meditation and what that feels like. What happens, just in brief, going in to the breath, until the breath fills your whole mind, until the breath is with you effortlessly, and then the breath, as it were, starts to glow. It becomes what we call the beautiful breath. It becomes very peaceful, very happy. You're watching it without any effort whatsoever. And then the breath disappears. And in its place, you see this beautiful light. We call it the nimitta in meditation. When this happens, you cannot imagine it, you cannot make it happen. It happens according to nature, when the causes are in position and this beautiful light appears in the mind. And it always is accompanied by great feelings of energy and bliss and happiness. And if you know your meditation, you can really let go. You can actually go deep into that light and go into the jhana experiences. now. That's what happens in meditation. In those jhanic experiences, very often you're not breathing. My teacher Ajahn Chah had these experiences. When he was very sick, he could not speak, he was paralyzed for many years. And this occasion when some of our monks were looking after him, and while they're looking after him, one evening he stopped breathing. He wasn't breathing at all. Now, at that particular time, because he was a famous monk, it was the king of Thailand was paying for a nurse to give him 24 hours attention, 8-hour shifts. The nurse was supplied by the local hospital, but paid for by the palace. As well as a male nurse, there was usually 3 or 4 monks doing services for the teacher. That particular evening, Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. And the nurse panicked. He wanted to try and get Ajahn Chah breathing again. The monk said, no, leave him alone. He does this all the time. Not all the time, but quite regularly. He's just going into deep meditation. But imagine that was you. Would you believe that? This nurse didn't. According to the story, he wasn't concerned so much about Ajahn Chah dying. He knew he'd have to die someday. He didn't want Ajahn Chah to die on his shift. So because of that, he wanted to try and revive him. And the other monk said, no, leave him alone. No, I can't leave him alone. He's dying. He said, no, he's not. He's in deep meditation. They came to a compromise. The doctor, or the nurse rather, took blood samples every few minutes just to make sure that the blood was oxygenated. Because as long as there's oxygen in the blood, then the brain is getting enough fuel. And therefore, there's no danger to life. There's no threat. And even though Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing for quite a few hours, the oxygen level in the blood always remained the same. Interesting experiment done on someone in deep meditation. And after a while, he just came out of meditation and started breathing again. This is what happens. It's like a temporary death. Now, the other story I'd like to tell about one of the people who comes here. I can't see him this evening. It's a great story, one of my favorites. You've heard it before, but this is Ajahn Brahm's old favorites. He was a meditator in Perth. He was only meditating usually for 30 minutes at a time. This time he was at home in his bedroom, and he really got into deep meditation. So deep that after a while, his wife came into the bedroom to check on him, wondering what he was doing. And when she saw him there, he was so still, not moving. She had a closer look. She couldn't see him breathing at all. Now, what would you do if that was your husband? What she did was ring 000 to get the ambulance. And the ambulance came at top speed with the sirens going. In your meditation, are you disturbed by the sound of the traffic? Imagine by the sound of an ambulance pulling up in front of your house. The medics came, felt his pulse. There was no pulse. So straight away, they put him in the stretcher, put him in the back of the ambulance, and with the sirens blaring at top speed, they sped him to Charlie Gardner's, where they put him in the emergency room. There they put on the ECG, which measures your heartbeat. You've seen that probably in the movies. Apparently there's a TV show called ER. This was a real thing. Because when they put the ECG on, the screen showed a flat line. Ding, 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 emergency, heart failure, ding, ding, ding. I don't know if that's what it does, but that's what I imagine it does, because I've never seen that movie. Heart failure, his heart wasn't beating. It showed it on the screen. The next put on the EEG to see if there's any brain activity. Again, another straight line. Ding, 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 emergency, brain death. His brain wasn't working, neither was his heart. It was proven on the machines. And so what they did with him, they put on the electric pads to put electric shocks through his body to try and get him going again. Many, many times, apparently, according to his wife, they tried to shock him back into life again. Nothing worked. Nothing worked at all. Until he decided to come out of his meditation. True story. He came out of his meditation, sort of bent up, wondered where he was. How did he get into the hospital? He went to meditation in his bedroom. Imagine that was you. You meditated here on a Friday evening, and you woke up from your meditation. It wasn't actually a bomb ringing the bell. It was just, ding, ding, ding. You're not supposed to be breathing. But nothing wrong with him at all. Absolutely healthy. And he said, I remember this was the funny part of the story when he told me this. I can hardly keep myself from laughing. He said the worst part of the whole experience, all the time he was just blissed out, fully aware all the time, but not of his body, aware elsewhere. He said the worst part of the whole experience was when he was going home, because he got such a scolding from his wife. Oh, she really let him have it. Making him pause, don't ever do that again. It really worried him, worried her. So this is just an example of what happens when you get into deep meditation. It's like learning what happens when you die. The important thing is, even though the brain is not working, even though the heart is not beating, the conscious process still carries on. That's the most important point of that story. Why I keep telling it? Consciousness survives the death of the body. So when you die, that's what happened to you. The brain won't work. The heart will stop. People may be trying to do all sorts of things and you won't be aware of it at all. But you will be aware of something else. Sometimes people, they float out of the body. They can see what's going on. One of the people I met, they always tell me these stories. They're great stories. He was Yugoslav man. As a boy, there's something wrong with him. He went into hospital. They gave him an operation. And he died on the table. He went floating up above his body. He was only about a 6 or 7 year old boy at the time. This must be about 40 or 50 years ago in Yugoslavia during the time when it was communist under Tito. And as he was floating up, he said he knew, even though he's only a 7 year old boy with no scientific knowledge at all, he knew intuitively the doctors, the surgeons were looking in the wrong place. He knew where the problem was in his body, even though he was floating up above it. And so he said he just willed that the doctor would look where the problem was. And as soon as that thought arose in his mind, as soon as he thought that, one of the doctors turned around, looked at the spot, said, "Hey, here's the problem." And so they fixed him up. And he survived. He came back into his body again and carried on with his life. But he said from that time on, he could always leave his body at will. Any time he could float out of his body. And he said, ever since he was in prison, there was no problem at all. He could leave whenever he wanted, and they couldn't stop him. If he wanted to watch a movie, he'd just float out of his body and go and watch one. Nice trick, isn't it? But anyhow, what it was actually showing is this is what happens when a person dies. Going out of the body and actually being able... Many people have had that experience or have known of others had that experience of actually seeing your body down there. It happened to one of the monks once. I won't tell you who he is, but he's a famous abbot. He's been here. He was once just meditating, and he got into some deep meditation. Next thing he knew, he was up on a tree, looking down at himself, walking meditation. He said it just scared the life out of him, almost. But it was real, just a meditation experience, separating the mind from the body. And this is what happens when a person dies. They see this. I know that even when I was a school teacher, one of my kids in the class told me he had a motorbike accident. Next thing he knew, he was floating up in the air, and he looked down upon this mangled body. And the first thing, it was a shock. Hey, that's me down there. He was watching himself. Fortunately, the injuries weren't that bad, and he came back again. Well, that story of the federal MP, Graham Edwards, in Vietnam, stood on a landmine and blew his legs off. Next thing he knew, after the explosion, floating up above the paddy fields of Vietnam without a care in the world, until he remembered his young wife and child back in Perth. That brought him back into the body. As soon as he came back into the body, huge lot of pain, and then was unconscious. Next thing he knew, waking up in a field hospital.
Many people have those experiences. They've been recorded, and it's not by sort of crazy people, not by people on drugs, all types. Children who know no better, who haven't got a philosophy or a religion. This is what happens to many people. Not every person, but many people. So this is what happens when a person dies. They're still there afterwards. Understanding that this life goes on, obviously what happens after that, when you're sort of you're dead and you're floating around, you then go to a new rebirth. Another place, another life. And in Buddhism we have this whole series of hell realms, heaven realms, animal realms, human realms. And don't think that human beings are somehow superior to animals. Some animals are more intelligent than humans. At least animals don't go around drinking alcohol at Christmas. So be careful of the bottle. We used to say in Thailand that it's not only when a person dies that sometimes they can become ghosts. And we always used to say in Thailand the most dangerous ghost in Thailand when I was a young monk, and now these ghosts have come to Perth. They're called the bottle ghost. The most dangerous ghost of all is called the bottle ghost. It kills many people every year. It invades their mind and makes them stupid. It makes them sort of takes over their mind. It's a real case of possession. Have you ever seen anyone possessed by a ghost? I've seen many people possessed by the bottle ghost. I think you've all figured it out now. It lives in the bottles of whiskey and bottles of alcohol. You open up the lid and you drink too much of that stuff and you get possessed and it kills many people. So be careful of the ghost who lives in the bottle. That's why we call it spirits, isn't it? The bottle ghost. So anyhow, so this is what happens when a person dies. And when they die, you actually go off to other realms. There are ghost realms. There are angel realms, heavenly realms. All traditions have their spirits, heavenly spirits. And amazing how similar they are. Buddhist traditions. I was just talking yesterday about the Jewish tradition. All the different levels of heaven in the Kabbalah. In the Kabbalah, the Jewish traditions believe in rebirth. I almost got one of the rabbis into trouble because one of my friends, the rabbi, was Moshe Bernstein. He came to our Waysak ceremony last year. Because he used to be the chaplain or the spiritual director at Carmel School, and he used to come to our monastery every year. Sometimes he used to go out to his school, talk about Buddhism, and he was such a really great guy. And he said, "You know, we all believe in rebirth, reincarnation, just like you Buddhists do." I was really surprised. I never thought that Jewish tradition believed in rebirth. But then another time, I'd just given a talk at the hospice in Shenton Park with another Jewish rabbi, and I said, "Oh, it's really good that you Jewish faith believes in rebirth." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Oh, you know, Rabbi Bernstein just told me." He said, "Oh, him." I really got him into trouble. But some Jewish tradition believe in rebirth. Even some of the Muslim tradition, the Druze, who live in Lebanon, I think. They're all into rebirth as well. So it's interesting. And this is actually what happened. We go from realm to realm, from life to life. It's a story about this monkey who many of the monkeys in Thailand were actually not treated very well at all. It's supposed to be a Buddhist country, but I don't know why they don't treat animals very well. But very often, if they find an animal that's been mistreated, to give it some sort of sanctuary, they take it to monasteries and leave it in the monastery. So in this particular case, there's a monkey who'd been mistreated, and so they took it to a monastery. It's one of these forest monasteries, one of the monks, you know, from Thailand who comes here every now and again. And they let this monkey stay in the monastery. And he was a very intelligent monkey, and after a while he actually identified with the monks. That was his mates, that was his group of people. So when it came to tea time, they had to give the monkey a cup of tea as well. So he'd be sitting there with the monks would have their cup of tea, and the little monkey would have his cup of tea as well. And he'd have to get one, otherwise he'd never really play around. And he was very protective of the head monk. Because what happens sometimes, some people will be cheeky
to the monks, like, you know, some of you are sometimes, aren't you? But this monkey, he would actually find out who the cheeky ones were. And he would go to one person in the line and, you know, allow them to pet him, because he's a very friendly little monkey, and they'd pet him and stroke him, it was very nice, and then he'd go to the next person, the next person. And when you get to the cheeky one, he'd bite him. It's karma. So just but apparently, eventually the monkey was so protective, he'd actually, any noisy vehicles outside the monastery, to try and keep it quiet, he'd actually try and chase them away, and one day he actually got killed by one of the trucks. But this is a true story. That monk was a very, very good meditator and actually saw sort of the stream of consciousness leave the monkey, go into the village where there was one of the villagers was pregnant, and saw, you know, through his meditation, saw the monkey enter the mother's womb. And he told, he shouldn't have done this, but he told the other monks about this. And after about another 7 or 8 months, when the lady gave birth to a little boy, that boy was exceptionally hairy. And he sure is a little monkey. And I don't know what it's going to be like, because it's the local village, and all the monks know the story. Many of the people, and they say, we know who you were in your previous life. You were that monkey who used to stay in the monastery, and it was true. So actually the transition from the animal realm to the human realm is not that hard, especially like the higher animals. You know, the cats, the dogs, the elephants, the cows. It was actually, I was looking in one newspaper about people who saw seen animals cry. I told a story before, it's a long story, it's not really the time now, about the cow which cried in the prison when it was about to be killed. People have seen elephants cry. Even sort of, I'm not sure, cats or dogs exhibit human emotions. And I think many of you who've had cats and dogs know that they are not that far from the human realm. And they can get reborn one to the other. So people who say, how can there be rebirth, because there's more human beings alive today than probably has ever died? Where have they all come from? And of course, you know that there's many human beings alive today, but the number of animals, especially the higher animals, has really dropped quite considerably. Many of the animals have been now reborn as human beings. And it explains much about certain sections of society. So this rebirth actually happens. First of all, if you get into deep meditation, you can actually just see what happens. What happens when a person floats out of their body? Those of you who have heard those stories, they go out of the body, they see what's going on, and then they go out, off to the light. Have you ever heard that before? They go floating into the light. In meditation, that's called that nimitta, which is the light which you see in the mind. You know what that light actually is. That is how one perceives this thing we call the mind. In Buddhism, there's 6 senses. Always has been, always will be. 6 senses. I don't know why it was that in, you know, Western psychology or Western culture, we've only got 5. Asian culture is one ahead of the West. They've got an extra sense to, they're more sensible. We've lost some sense in the West in more ways than one. And the sense we've lost is a sense of mind. Even in science, I was a theoretical physicist. When I started discovering quantum science, quantum physics, one of the wonderful things which came out of that, what inspired me, was hard physics, basically maths, proved that you have to have an observer. That you can't just have, like, you know, things out there without consciousness. It was the first time in hard physics that consciousness came into the equation, had to. And there's no way out of that. And that really shocked a lot of physicists. It could not be objective anymore, because the observer was fundamental to what goes on out there. It was fundamental. So consciousness is a sense which is apart from seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching.
when those five senses, those external senses, stop, when you can't see anymore, when you can't hear anymore, when you can't smell, you can't taste, when you can't feel your body, when those five senses are gone, your body dies. That's what they're all about. They're all connected with the body. That's what the body is. The body is a vehicle for seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, for experiencing the world through those senses. When those turn off, the body dies, either temporarily or permanently. And what you're left with is that last sense, the sixth sense, the mind. And that's what you experience, is that beautiful light. That's what I've written in my books. That's a reflection of the mind. That's why when you get into that stage of meditation, you've got to be very careful. Because sometimes when they see this nimitta, this light which comes up in the mind, sometimes it's a bit dirty. Sometimes it's not all that pure. And you know why? What you've been doing. That's where you're honest, because you're seeing yourself. Not what you want to think, not who you expect yourself to be, but what you've actually been doing. As a pure person, we see a beautiful light. A person who's been heedless, selfish, cruel, will see not a very nice light at all. That's looking at themselves. That's the mind. That's like the inner thing inside of you, which keeps going on from life to life. The flow, the stream of consciousness, what the Buddha said. Now when one understands what that is, one understands how rebirth happens. One understands what happens, and that why you go to this realm or why you go to that realm after you die. The reason why you get reborn is two reasons, two causes for rebirth. One is your desire, your aspiration, where you want to go. And the second is, you know, your wherewithal. You know, it's like, I give always a simile of like a person who goes to the airport. They want to go to Paris, say. If you're going to get to Paris, first of all, you have to want to go there. And number two, you need the fare. You need the money. You need the ticket and the visa and everything else. Otherwise, you'll never get there. Even if you really, really want to go, you need the wherewithal, the desire and the wherewithal. The desire is, you know, your craving, your wanting. The wherewithal is your karma. This is what the Buddha said. Technically, for those of you who know deeper meditation, this is what dependent origination is all about. Paticca Samuppada. It says how rebirth happens. Through craving and through karma, that's where you get reborn. So first of all, you want to go somewhere. You want to get reborn somewhere. And you've got the karmic causes to get there. But it's amazing that sometimes people, even though they could get reborn in wonderful places, they've got the wherewithal, but they don't want to. And they get sort of settled for terrible places. I remember being a young man in London, and you go out at the night, go out for the, you know, Saturday evening or Friday. In those days, there wasn't a Buddhist centre where I could go to on a Friday night, so you go down a pub with your mates. But everybody knew there were some pubs in London where there'd always be a fight, every night, every Friday night. And in some pubs, you can just have a drink with your friends and have a good time. And I couldn't figure out, why is it that some people would actually go to those violent pubs? I mean, I can understand it was stupid to me, but they'd want to go there. It's just like, why do some people want to get reborn in bad places? Because they want to. Stupidity. So some of our wanting, our desires, are based on delusion, stupidity. We think it's wonderful, we think it's nice. You know that lovely story, that famous story of the two monks? I'm going to tell this again because I love this story. Two monks, after they died, one got reborn in the heaven realm, the other one got reborn as a worm in a pile of dung. It's a great story. A worm in a pile of dung. Now they were mates. And just like in the Australian tradition of mateships, you'll never abandon your mate. So the heavenly being, when he got reborn in heaven, thought, where's my mate? I can't just sort of abandon my mate. He looked around heaven, couldn't find his mate anywhere. Used his psychic powers to search the human realms, couldn't find his mate there either. Oh my goodness, surely he hasn't been reborn in the animal realm. I looked all around the animal realm, couldn't find his mate there. Surely not the creepy crawlies. Oh my goodness, he found him. He found his best mate when they were monks together previous life. Because of some bad karma, he'd been reborn as a worm in a pile of stinking dung. I said, I can't allow that. So he went in front of that pile of dung. He manifested. And he told his mate, said, friend, we were monks in our life before. We were best of friends. Now because of some unfortunate karma, you've been reborn in a stinking pile of dung. I've been reborn in the heaven realm. Come with me. And the little worm came out and said, before I go, I want to ask one question. Yeah, ask. He said, up in heaven, is there any dung? And the heavenly being said, no, there's no dung there. And then I'm not going, said the worm. And he because worms, dung worms, they like dung. And for them, if this place has got no dung, it's not worth going. It's like a person goes out at night. If it's got no alcohol, it's not worth going. So like dung, isn't it? So the heavenly beings try to explain what it was like in the heavenly realms. Just so beautiful, so wonderful music, great food, so peaceful, so lovely. Yes, I know, but there's no dung. I don't want to go there. So no matter what the heavenly being said, the worm just wouldn't go. So there are times when you have to sort of take matters into your own hands. And this was a time when the angel had to take the worm into its own hands. He tried to grab the worm because he thought, if I could only take the worm so we could actually see what heaven is like. It's just like sometimes you have your kids or your friends. You want to drag them to the Buddhist center so they can actually see what it's like. If they could only see, they would enjoy it. But the worm didn't want to go. And so as soon as this heavenly being could catch hold of the worm would struggle and shout, hey, leave me alone, leave me alone, don't. And because he was covered with dung, you know what dung is like, it's really sort of slippery, slimy stuff. So because it was really sort of greasy, he could escape. And as soon as he escaped from the heavenly being's grip, he just wiggled right into the middle of the dung. But if you're a good mate, you don't give up easy. So the heavenly angel held his nose, put his hand in the middle of the dung, and searched all around in the pile of dung for his mate. He found him again, pulled him out, hey, leave me alone. And the little worm wriggled again and escaped. Every time, he almost got him out of the pile of dung, but the worm really didn't want to go. So it would always go back into the pile of dung. In the end, the angel had to leave his old mate to the pile of dung. And he had to go up to heaven, and the worm stayed in the pile of dung. When the Buddha told that story, as I tell that story, for those who've been coming for many years, have been trying very hard to pull you out of your pile of dung. You get you here on a Friday, and then you go right back into it afterwards. You don't want to go. Leave me alone. Why is it? Because we like our pile of dung, don't we? It's nice. We don't realize it's dung. It's called attachment because of stupidity. That's what happens why people, when they want to get reborn, now if they like dung, they get to go reborn in a part of dung and you can't stop them. So this is what happens with rebirth. You'll be very careful. Be wise. Be smart and know what dung is and what heaven is. What real happiness is and what suffering is. What peace is. And what sort of irritation is. Know what real happiness is. Then you know where you want to go. And have the good karma, you can get there. So when you die, very often it's what you've been inclining to all your life. What you really think is happiness. What you want to be reborn as. If you've got the good karma, that's where you'll go afterwards. So where do you want to be reborn? In your next life. Many, when I was young in Thailand, they said, oh, we want to be reborn in the West. I said, don't be stupid. Be reborn in the West. That's a terrible place to be reborn. It's, oh, it's nice and rich there. I want to be reborn in a pile of dung called wealth. I said, oh, stupid. But this is actually, where do you want to be reborn? Is that really heaven or is it a pile of dung? So this is actually one of the problems there. So also the Buddha actually said about like rebirth, not only we go on and on until we actually learn. It's like going back to school again and again and again. It's only when we finish school that we don't need to be reborn anymore. We have to learn That's what this whole world is about. That's what life is about, learning. Are you wise yet? Are you finished yet? You really know who you are and how this life works? If you don't, you'll have to come back again. So this Buddhist Society of West Australia gives crash courses in wisdom to be able to get out of samsara, to finish school in this lifetime, so you don't need to keep coming back. Because otherwise, even if you come back to this human realm, think about it. Nappies again. Think about it. I don't know if there's any, probably no schoolies here who've finished their TEE. Imagine having to do it all over again. Another 12 years. Oh my goodness. All of those of you who've retired, you're going to have to go back to work again. All of those who think you've got rid of your kids, here they come back again. Another time. My goodness, do you really want that? If you say, oh yes, I do. Imagine having another little baby. Another thing would see? Attached to your pada duck. So this is actually what happens to us. But the Buddha said about not just the craving, but also the karma, the why. Because there are some lessons we still need to learn. And sometimes that we have to keep coming back, even to places we don't want to be. This is why the Buddha actually said that sometimes if you are stingy, if you are not generous, if you don't give donations, and this is a good point to point out the Bangladesh orphanage. Every Christmas time we do a collection for these poor orphans in Bangladesh, Buddhist orphans in a Muslim country, third world. They really get the bottom end of everything. So we actually support them here every Christmas. If you're generous, they say you're going to be rich in your next lifetime. It seems quite fair. It's just, isn't it? It sounds right. If you're generous, then you're going to be rich. It's as if you know what to do with money, then actually life gives you more. And the what to do with money is enjoy some for yourself, but use it to help others as well. That's the best use of this resource called money. If you're stingy, you don't know what to do with your money, you keep it all in the bank and you count it every week, see how much you've got. You plan for your retirement, and when you die, you've got all this money left in the bank, which all goes to your kids or the government. What a waste of time. So be generous. If you're stingy, you get reborn as being poor. Because you were given money, you didn't know how to make use of it. So now you have to know what it's like to do without. How better to know what generosity means than to be on the receiving end, to be poor, to not have any money, to be hungry. Anyone who's really ever been hungry would never pass by someone else who needs something to eat. And you know what it's like, personally. That's why sometimes we need to learn through being poor, through being hungry, so we're never ungenerous ever again. They say that if you're an angry person, if you're an angry person in your next life, you will be ugly. So all you women who argue with your husbands and get angry at them, be careful. You're not going to be able to get a husband next time. You're going to be so ugly. And the same goes for you men as well. If you get really angry, you're going to get so ugly that no woman in the right mind will come near you. And it seems fair, doesn't it? If we don't know how to live with another person, then we'll be repelled. We repel other people. But if you're kind, if you're forgiving, if you're forbearing, then you become a beautiful person. That's where they say the beauty comes from. All the beautiful people were people who, even if they were told off, they'd never get angry back. And that seems fair. If they've got a beautiful heart, forbearing heart, forgiving heart, they deserve to be beautiful. Beautiful hearts need to be beautiful people. They say, if you're envious, you will never get anywhere in the world. But if you celebrate others' success, you'll be always influential. I don't know how that works with politicians. But maybe it was because in their last life. And so, this is actually what happens, why people are reborn. If you're negative, depressed, against the world, then where would you get reborn? You get reborn in a negative realm. That's why the understanding the law of karma and how rebirth happens, there's never any reason, you know, to, say, take your own life and because of depression. Imagine what would happen if you thought that that was a way out. After you kill your body, your mind is still there. If you were depressed before, you'll be even more depressed afterwards. Can't do anything right. Can't even kill yourself. And I think, it's not just a joke, because I think if people would take on board rebirth many lives, just killing the body is no solution because the mind continues. And depression, negativity, is in the mind. It's not in the body. Not the body doesn't feel depressed, it's the mind. The inner being feels depressed, negative, upset, frustrated. It carries on after you die. That's why suicide is not really an option. It happens to many people, especially young people, because they have got a feeling about many lives. I think one of the reasons why it's not so popular or not so common in Asian countries, I think, is because of the idea of rebirth. That's maybe one of the reasons. So this is what happens. But if a person has committed suicide, we want to sort of try and get them to forgive themselves, to get rid of the depression. The body being killed is not the point. It's the mind you're always concerned about. Same when a person's a ghost, they linger around afterwards. It's the mind which is a problem. They live or they die. That's not so much of the problem as the mind. There's many more important things than life and death. It's like how you live and how you die is most important in Buddhism. Not the fact you are alive or you die. It's the how, the quality, the karma, what you're doing, what you're making of your life. So understanding like rebirth in this sense, there's so much evidence, and I'm really almost like on a mission to try and promote the idea of rebirth. I think we'd have a much better society, a much more kinder, caring society, once more people start to go back to the old ways of European ways, the ever-present ways of Asian ways, of taking on board that this is not your first life, it won't be your last one. You haven't come from just nowhere. You've come with a past. You come with your history, your karma. And you go with your karma as well. When you say you don't take your wealth with you, true, but you take your karma with you. Wherever you go, you are heirs to your karma, born of your karma, said the Buddha. This is actually the truth of things. And I think we'll have a much more compassionate society, a much more understanding society, a much wiser society, who won't worry so much when young people die, because they know that they can have another life afterwards, another chance. We won't be so heedless, because if we've got away with it in this life, it doesn't mean we're going to get away with it in the next life. If the ACO or the CID don't get you in this life, the karma police will get you in your next life. You can't get away with anything. And you know you always get rewards. It's a sense of justice. And that sense of justice is so important. Because when there's no sense of justice, there's no sense of fairness, there's an invitation for like the law of so-called the jungle. The most powerful, the cruelest, the one who gets away with it wins. And that doesn't feel right to me. That's not the sort of world I'd like to live in. I'd like to live in a world of fair, of moral cause and effect, where good people, kind people, generous people eventually get rewarded with happiness, where the cruel, selfish, hurtful people will not get punished, but will have to learn from their mistakes, the stupidity, so they'd never do that ever again. So law of karma and rebirth. And if you don't believe what I've said in this evening's talk, haha, you certainly will in your next life. When you die, you can come back and tell me. Yes. And I'll say, I told you so. So thanks a lot for listening to this evening's talk on rebirth. Okay. Ajahn Chah used to say, if you're going to do it, give it everything you've got. If you're going to clap, clap. If you're not going to clap, don't clap. Very good. Very good. If you're going to boo, boo.
Boo.
Okay, that's enough for this evening. Any questions on this evening's talk? It's question time for the talk. Okay, very good, because you know the other thing which the Buddha said about the reason why people are going to be reborn stupid in the next life? Correct. Don't ask questions in this one, you're stupid in your next life. Aha, when an enlightened person dies. When a person knows all the lessons in school, do they have to go back to school again? No. You graduate. So you're free from having to go to school again. You're free from nappies. You're free from all this old age, sickness and death. Isn't that nice? I reckon. Where does the mind go? It goes back to where it came from. That's why last couple of weeks ago I went to Wollaston College to teach some meditation there. The last time I went there before, there was an inauguration of Zen Roshi, Ross Bolota. He's an old friend of mine. I'm the Theravada, you've got the Zen groups of Theravada, we're all mates. And so, apparently, according to that tradition, when he became a Roshi, everyone had to go up and say something. So I told him the story about this Zen man who was walking down the street in his robes, and I was walking down the roads, and somebody came up and said, "Now, why didn't you go back to where you came from?" And I said, "That's very Zen." And I told that story and they thought it was funny. That's called xenophobia. Okay. I know I'm going to come back in my next life if I come back because I've had to listen to bad jokes all my life because that's my bad karma. Yes. Okay. The point is, I answered that before when saying human beings, animals, ghosts, heavenly beings, is many different realms. So you don't go 1 million into 2 million. So the reason why we've got so many human beings is because many animals have taken rebirth in the human realm. Where have all the animals gone? Somebody asked that, in heaven, in the Christian heaven, where do dogs and cats go? Imagine if the cats and your nice pet mice go to the same heaven. What will the cats eat? So anyway, no, that's because the animals, just like other beings, that they will go from one realm to another realm. Even the Greek philosopher Heraclitus recorded as saying he remembered a past life as a fish. This was 2,200 years ago or something, in Athens in ancient Greece. One of the great Greek philosophers claimed in his writing that he used to be a fish before. So it's not a new thing, this rebirth, reincarnation thing. We get reborn from the animal realm, the human realm, heavenly realm, ghost realm, many realms. That's why we've got a lot of people in the human realm right now, because there's been it's like houses, there's many vacancies. But there's not many vacancies in the animal realm. So many animals have become extinct, or their numbers are just really, really down. And look at the dolphins. They exhibit so many human characteristics, so much intelligence. Somebody pointed out, this was actually Peter Singer, the Australian philosopher. He's over in, was it Princeton or somewhere now? He wrote his book, Animal Rights. And one of the things he was writing there, as a philosopher, not a Buddhist, he was actually saying that the distinction we make between human beings and animals can be compared, not the same, but is comparable to the distinction white people made towards coloured people sort of 200, 300 years ago. Before we called it racism. He said, in the future, the way we treat animals we'll call speciesism. As if animals don't feel pain. As if animals can be exploited. If animals can be tortured. Because they're not the same as us. In Buddhism and Hinduism as well, we say, no, no, no. Animals aren't that different. Animals also feel. Animals are intelligent. If you don't believe that, you ask anyone who's had a dog or a cat. Another animal that's so human. Many times people ask me to chant for their dog who's died. They would do a Buddhist service for a cat who's very close to them. And I'm very happy to do that. Because I know that is not an animal, that's a being in there. So that's actually the answer to your question. It comes from many other realms. Okay, one more question, and then we have to leave the next questions. Just right over there. If you want to have any other questions, you have to ask them in your next life. Yes, question over there. Yeah. I understand the question. It's a long question, there's many parts to it, but just so I can only deal with a couple of parts. There's one part which stood out to me when you're talking about that is saying that this age is somehow specially bad or specially difficult or specially troublesome. And having studied history reasonably well, I don't really think that is true. There have been cycles in our world, cycles of peace and cycles of wars, cycles of terror and cycles of civilization. And this has just been just the way of our world. We just go through cycles. And it gets better, it gets worse, it gets better, it gets worse. But I see that this is just like being in a school. In a school you expect to have, in a school of the world, to have greed, to have selfishness. But alongside that you'll have the beauty, the selflessness, and the charity, and the heroes in the world, the Mandelas, as well as the Saddam Husseins. So you have both there, and you always will have that both there. It's like somebody, I imagine once this alien came down from Mars and came to one of our schools in WA. And he'd been here 20 years ago and he said, nothing has changed. There's still these little children in grade one, they're still doing the same things with the plasticine. There's still the people in grade five, grade six, grade 12, they're still doing the same lessons. But of course he doesn't realize people have graduated through in those 20 years. They're not the same people. So the world seems to be, the same. There's always wars, there's always violence, there's always love, there's always wonderful people, there's always monsters. But actually this is people graduating through, flowing through this school of life. If it was a perfect world, it would not be a school. There'd be nothing to learn. The world is like this for us to learn. We do need to see, as it were, the greed in others. To see just, I'm not going to do that in my life. As a person who's just learning in this world, just come into this world. And they aren't very wise or learned yet. Just like a person coming into grade one or two, I can't really criticize them. They're just starting out. I can't praise the kid in year 12 because they've been here a long time. They've learnt a lot. Maybe it is the Saddam Husseins or the Adolf Hitlers. Maybe they just started out and they've still got a lot to learn yet. The Mandelas are about to graduate. But is one better than the other? Or is it just that one has been learning more and is about to graduate? Different way of looking at it. It's only a suggestion. But it's a big question and there really isn't time to actually answer it fully. So if you'd like to come up afterwards and ask that question, I'm happy to discuss it. The same with you as well. If you'd like to come up and ask a question privately, then you are most welcome to. So that finishes the talk about rebirth and many other things this evening.